Heavenly Father, we thank you for our time together this morning, and we pray for Graham as he brings us your word. We ask that you would help us to be eager and attentive as we listen, and that we would be quick and willing to obey. Lord, we pray that as we turn our minds towards you, that we would listen and that we would love you more. We ask this in your name. Amen.
Thank you very much. Well, let me just make a couple of comments as we start, just about studying the Psalms. I just thought it would be worth commenting on that, just very briefly, really. The Psalms are, you can think of them a little bit like the hymn book of the Old Testament. They're in poetry form, and a number of them, or perhaps even all of them, were certainly supposed to be sung. So this is what people would have sung at various moments when people were gathered at the temple and so on. And so we need to just remember that as we work our way through them and study them. We're looking at songs, not letters. And that's why there's quite a lot of sort of repetition. I mean, in here, the one enthroned in heaven laughs, the Lord scoffs. It says the same thing twice. You know, he laughs, he scoffs. And there's an awful lot of that kind of saying the same thing several times or working round a theme and so on, rather than, if you like, careful, logical argument. The other thing about being songs is that there are sorts of things that we should think about singing. If you were here last week, we talked about blessed are those who don't live this way, but who love God's law and live this way. And that's not just something you've got to sit down and analyse and go, yep, I think that's right. Blessed are those people. Very good. Right. We should think about singing that in the sense of thinking, I won't sing to you, please, you know, I'll spare you that agony of me trying to set Psalm 1 to music in an impromptu fashion. But we should think about thinking to ourselves, blessed are these people. Isn't that great? It should bring out a heart response, because it's a song of praise, a song of encouragement. Sing to other people, blessed are those people, Doug. You know, we're singing it to each other. It should have that sort of feel to it. And so it's an interesting question to think, you know, would I, you know, having studied a psalm, you know, how would I sing that? Who would I sing it to? What would the tune be like? That sort of thing. If I remember, I'll mention that at the end on this psalm. The other thing is just to recognise that they are very variable as to who they are written about and applied to. So, for example, Psalm 1 last week, you'd think of as being a very general psalm. Blessed is this person who lives like this. And it's applied to anybody. And that's fine, so we should take it to ourselves. And the New Testament sometimes quotes psalms and says, look, here's an example of how we should live in humility or loving God's law or something, and lots of psalms are like that. Other psalms, though, are very specific about a certain situation. So if you just glance in your Bible to Psalm 3, it says a psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom. And to understand Psalm 3, you have to think, well, where on earth is this stuff about fleeing from Absalom? And you have to go back to the books of Samuel and read about when David had to run away from Jerusalem because his son was trying to kill him. And you have to understand something of that event to know what he's saying here. You see, so you have to actually do a bit of cross-referencing. It's a very specific thing. Now, of course, it will apply to us as well, but it will probably apply to us when we're in something vaguely akin to David's situation when he was fleeing from Absalom. I mean, I'm not sure many of us will be running away from our children trying to kill us, but there'll be some parallels probably. But we have to understand the situation. You see the point. And then lastly, some of the psalms, often referred to as the kingly psalms or the royal psalms or something, are about the king of Israel specifically. And such is the case with our psalm today. And I won't say any more on that because you'll see the reasoning as we go through it. So just to say that they're songs, we should treat them as songs, and we should be aware they come in quite a lot of different varieties. We shouldn't treat them all the same. And some of them may apply more to the king, and that, well, I think, will show will end up being applied to Jesus. Some of them will apply to us directly. Anyway, there's enough sort of scattered thoughts on Psalms. We'll get into Psalm 2, which I'm going to call Look to the King. I was listening to some stuff on the radio quite some time ago now. It was some lectures. I don't normally listen to this sort of thing, but it was some lectures on the human brain. It was fascinating, I have to say. It was how our brain works, how we're conscious of things, our sort of perception of the world around us. It was a bit highbrow stuff, but I found it interesting. Anyway, it mentioned stuff about consciousness of God and whether we had a soul and that sort of thing. And in the question time that followed, someone asked the lecturer, who was clearly a very impressive scientist, "Do you believe in God?" And he said, "If you mean some impersonal force out there somewhere, maybe. But if you mean an old guy who's watching me and will punish me, no." And the questioner asked, "Is that because of science?" And he replied, "Well, it's mainly common sense." And the audience laughed. I thought that was an intriguing moment because he effectively admitted his science couldn't actually answer the question, but we all know the answer, don't we? It's just common sense. And that's the standard position, I take it, of the world around us in different forms. God is either not there at all, or if he is, he's a bit vague and mysterious, and whatever the case is, we don't really have to worry about him very much. And people who believe in a personal God that we're accountable to, who would punish people for rebelling against him, well, we're made to feel like we're just a bit naive, a bit childish, thinking such things. Now, the world's matured. It's grown up out of such ridiculous ideas. And it's just common sense, isn't it? Well, the Bible has a very different way of looking at that. And I think it's one we find here in Psalm 2, which tells us very much about ourselves and about God. The first thing this psalm describes is rebellion on earth. Verse 1. "Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain?" The nations are getting together, the peoples are getting together. It's focused on their kings and rulers, as you'll see in verse 2, but it's everybody. And what are they plotting and conspiring about? Verse 2, "The kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and against his anointed." They're plotting against God. Conspiring against God. And not just God, but his anointed. That's a phrase used to refer mainly... Sorry, sound effects. Refers mainly to God's king, the king of Israel at the time. Because he was anointed with oil in being enthroned as king. And he was called God's anointed one, God's ruler, God's king. So people are plotting against God and his king. And what are they doing? They're saying to each other, verse 3, "Let us break their chains and throw off their shackles." It's the picture of an animal, you know, a donkey or something, with a yoke around its neck that it would have to pull a cart with or something. And it wants to break free of such shackles, throw off the yoke. The nations are saying to themselves, "Let's be free of God and his king. We don't want them in charge. We don't want to be under their thumb, under their authority. Let's throw them off." And so this is rebellion against God and his king. And this is the heart, I think, of what the Bible calls sin. Sin is not simply the things we do wrong, although it includes that. It certainly isn't the sort of mistakes we make and the mess we make of our lives, although it will result in that. At root, it is rebellion against God, wanting freedom from his control. See, God made us to live under his rule, but we make a break for freedom and throw it off. We want to be in charge. And I would suggest that that is what is underneath all of the denials about God, whether he exists or doesn't. Even if he does, don't worry about him. He won't punish you. It's all a way of rebelling against God, throwing off his control. More specifically, this is rebellion against Jesus. I say that because this is what Luke records for us in Acts chapter 4. Peter and the other apostles, the followers of Jesus, are being persecuted. They get together and pray, and as they pray, they quote the verses we've just read, verses 1 and 2 of Psalm 2. And then they say the following words on the screen. Indeed, Herod and Pontius Pilate met together with the Gentiles and the people of Israel in this city to conspire against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed. See, they quote, the nations are conspiring and they're plotting against the Lord and against his anointed, and they say, it's just happened with Herod and Pontius Pilate and the Gentiles and the people of Israel. They all got together in it. And they plotted against God's anointed Jesus. In fact, let me just tell you, the word anointed is very simply the word for Messiah. You know that word, the Messiah who's promised in the Old Testament, the rescuer? Messiah simply means anointed one. And so in that sense, actually, in the Old Testament, every king was a little Messiah, because they were all anointed ones. But they all knew God promised to send the Messiah, the anointed one, who he'd kind of anoint like no one else, who'd be a king like no one else. And as we read on in Psalm 2, we'll see in a second, that's what he's talking about. And so Peter and John and the others look back at what happened and the events of Jesus' life and death, and they say, God sent his anointed king, and the nations have plotted together against him. And so this rebellion on earth against God, against his king, ultimately and supremely, it is rebellion against Jesus. At the crucifixion, we saw the world trying to throw off God, trying to break free from his control. That's how it's explained. And that rebellion against Jesus has continued ever since, hasn't it? And it might be very active. It might be outright denials of Jesus. It might be vehement rejection. But it might be very passive, as we were thinking earlier with Isaac being king. Someone said we could just ignore him. That's a way to reject him as well. And that is the attitude of most of our culture. You'll see it in I see it in the raised eyebrow of my neighbour when I talk about going to church. The slightly bemused expression that says, well, most of us know better than that. The world takes its stand. It gathers against God and his anointed one. And the thing is, we can easily feel very intimidated by that. See, this is ultimately why I feel embarrassed talking to my neighbour about Jesus, because he'll raise his eyebrow and go, oh yeah, poor you. Make some joke about only working one day a week or something, because he knows I'm a minister. And I feel embarrassed because I'm talking about Jesus in a world where he is rejected, in a world that plots against him and tries to throw him off. But our psalmist goes on. There may be rebellion on earth, but he goes on to say there is also laughter in heaven. Verse 4. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. I don't know if you think about the range of put-downs you can ever get about something, but I think this is one of the greatest put-downs ever. The threats of the nations sound so grand. The nations are getting together. The kings are banding together. Let's throw off their rule and so on. Break their chains. What's God doing? He's laughing out loud at them. You're going to what? When Isaac was a little bit younger, he used to love to wrestle me. Actually, he still loves to wrestle me. But when he was younger, sometimes I used to be able to sort of hold him in the air. You know, wrestling away, I'd pick him up and hold him here. And then he'd grab one of my arms with both hands and he'd say, "I've got you." He'd be like, "Yeah, you've got me. You know, I could just let go." I didn't, believe me, yeah. It's a bit like that. It's like they don't know what they're saying. You're going to what? You think you can do that? It's laughable. Except it's not fun and games here, is it? Verse 5, he rebukes them in his anger and terrifies them in his wrath. It's stupid, but it is also deadly serious because it's rebellion against God, their maker, and he is angry with them. He is wrathful, furious with these people for such an attitude. As Zach was saying, leading us just now, he is the king. He is God. How dare we respond in such a way? So what does God do? He tells us he's angry. How will this rebuke of his work? He says he's going to terrify them and rebuke them. He points us to his king. See what he says? The end of verse 5. He terrifies them, saying, "I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. I have set up my king. I've installed him, my anointed one." It's actually very emphatic. It's a kind of, as for me, what I've done, I've installed my king. That's the sense of it. And the idea is this: well, having installed him, having set him there, do you not think I'm going to rule through him? Do you not think I'll make sure he is seen to be king? Do you not think I'll make sure he's a victorious king? And to drum it in verse 7, we have the king now speaking. "I will proclaim the Lord's decree," he says, "the decree that God's given me about my kingship. He said to me," God said to me, "you're my son. Today I've become your father. Ask of me and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You'll break them with a rod of iron. You'll dash them to pieces like pottery." When God installed the king on the throne, a special relationship is established. They're like father and son, and the father will make sure the son is respected and honored. And he just says, "Ask me and I'll give you the nations. I'll give you the whole earth. The ends of the earth will be your inheritance, my king, my son." And for those who won't bow to your rule, you will break them with a rod of iron. You'll dash them to pieces like pottery. They'll just shatter before you. And so God's reply to this rebellion is to effectively laugh in their face and say, "My king's in place, my son is installed, and he will rule, and he will have the whole earth, and everyone will bow before him. He will be king." God points us to his king, and he assures us his king will rule. And of course, that promise was never fulfilled by any king of Israel. Oh, they may have had some military victories, but they never had the nations as an inheritance or the ends of the earth as their possession. And the nations around them who may have rebelled were never dashed to pieces like pottery. And so in reading this, while it may have had some application to the king of the day, if you like, I think even in their day they'd have had to read it and say, no, this is of a supreme king that God will bring. And these words look forward to Jesus. Now, we've already mentioned that at the beginning in terms of the plotting against him. But in Acts 13, the Apostle Paul is speaking. He talks about Jesus being killed and being raised. And he goes on to say this. We tell you the good news. What God promised our ancestors, he has fulfilled for us, their children, by raising up Jesus. As it is written in the second psalm, you are my son. Today I have become your father. When Jesus was raised from the dead, it was like he was enthroned at God's right hand. Another psalm is quoted of Jesus, Psalm 110, verse 1. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. God has said to Jesus, you sit here and I'll bring everyone before you as your footstool. Now, Jesus has always been Lord, but after his work on the cross and his resurrection, he's kind of enthroned and installed as king, just like we've been reading from Philippians 2. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place. I could give you other references. Hebrews 1 quotes these verses of Jesus. Revelation 19 quotes these verses of Jesus, and so on. The point is, to a rebellious world, God points us to his King, Jesus, and says, I've installed my king. I've promised the whole world to him. The nations are his inheritance. One day they'll be his, and all who oppose him will be shattered. And so while there is rebellion on earth, there is laughter in heaven because God has appointed his king, and in due time he will seem to be king and there'll be no rebellion against him. Two implications for us as to how we're to live. First of all, be warned. Verse 10, it's the conclusion the psalmist draws. Therefore, you kings, be wise, be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and celebrate his rule with trembling. Kiss the Son, or he will be angry. This is a warning against those who would plot against Jesus. Those who'd rebel. And be wise, he says. Be warned. Given what we've seen, what do you think the wise thing to do is? Realize how stupid this rebellion is. I mean, verse 1 began. Why do they conspire? Do you think they can get away with it? Of course they won't. What a stupid thing to do. All it's achieving is God's anger. All that lies ahead is Christ ruling the nations, and that for you would mean being shattered. You and your ways will be destroyed. You will face his wrath. So the wise thing to do is to lay down your arms and surrender. Stop your posturing and your fist shaking at God. Not only surrender, but serve him, verse 11. Serve him with fear and rejoice with trembling. Don't just lay down your arms and go, well, okay, then you are in charge. No, serve the one that you are fighting against because he is your true king. And rejoice. Celebrate the fact he's king and will have you as his subject. But do so with trembling because you know how foolish you've been and how dangerous that was. Kiss the Son, or he will be angry. That is, pay homage to him, honor him, respect him as your king. That's the wise thing to do, because he will be angry with you and destroy you. When it says on verse 12, it says, for his wrath can flare up in a moment. I'm not sure, it's not a brilliant translation. It sounds like Jesus might suddenly lose his rag, you know. Oh, be careful of that Jesus, he can lose it at any time. No, that's not the idea. More literally, it's that his wrath can burn quickly against them. And I think it's simply that it could happen any time. There's no warning, apart from this warning. It's not that God's current silence and his allowing you to rebel means all is well. No, his wrath could burn against you. So be wise, be warned. God is holding back at the moment, but he won't hold back forever. So kiss the Son before it's too late. A warning then to anyone rebelling. I don't know where you're at in your attitude to God. I guess most of us here would say, yep, we've bowed the knee, we've kissed the Son, we serve him. Well, I take it this is just an encouragement. Keep on in that attitude. Beware those stirrings of rebellion which still kind of come up again and again in our hearts. But maybe you haven't bowed the knee to him. Please hear what this psalm is saying. Be warned. God will win. Jesus will rule. The wise thing to do is to honor him and serve him now, to rejoice in fact he is so good and kind that he welcomes us back. Second implication, be warned, be reassured. See, for those who do serve God and trust him, this should reassure them that they are on the winning side. Last line of verse 12, blessed are all who take refuge in him. He's the king, he'll rule. Take refuge in him, throw your lot in with him, shelter under Jesus, and ultimately nothing can hurt you. You are blessed if you take your refuge there. You are truly in the best of places. As an old car advert, it's not on anymore, but I don't know if you remember it, there was one where this little girl was scared in the night. And you see her get up, a bit frightened and crying, and rather than going into her parents' room or something, she goes downstairs and into the garage and climbs into the car and closes the door and curls up on the back seat and goes fast asleep. And I can't remember what the byline was. It was something about the safest place to be or something. It was all about how wonderful and secure this car was. Well, anyway, it's a bit like that. Take refuge in Jesus. You are ultimately safe. Nothing can hurt you. And so be reassured when you feel the rebellion of the world around you. See, this means there is nothing for me ultimately to be frightened of or intimidated by. See, when I tell my neighbour I go to church and I see the raised eyebrow that says, well, we all know better than that, I should say to myself, no, that's rebellion, and God will show himself to be God, and his king will rule. I needn't worry about your opinion of me. In fact, you need to be warned about your attitude. You need to be told to come and kiss the Son before it's too late. Even when the world around us is plotting against God, we are to be encouraged and confident to stand for God, live for God, speak for God, be bold about God in the face of rebellion, because we know Psalm 2. Let's stop there. Why don't we just spend a moment? Why don't you turn to your neighbour, or just think yourself if you prefer not to chat, and just ask what something that strikes you from that, something you want to take away from that. If you can't think of anything to talk about, ask yourself what tune you think that might be sung to. Just a couple of moments, just to take a thought and just draw it into ourselves rather than going, that's nice, let's go home. Let's try and dwell on something for just a moment, then we'll pray together. So just a moment talking to a neighbour, and I'll draw us back together in a second. Okay. Okay, I hope that's been helpful in offering. It just takes a moment's thought to start to cement in something that's occurred to us. I wonder if we want to just take a moment to maybe enrich our discussion, maybe something that's occurred to you that you're struck by, want to take home. We can take some questions as well, but if you have a contribution or something you would think, oh yeah, that's really good, I want to remember that. So any questions or kind of contributions? Chris?
You sort of said, talked about the rebellion against kind of a secular, liberal, Western mindset, but rebellion takes many different forms, doesn't it? I think of my colleagues who aren't liberal, secularised Westerners.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Chris. So our rebellion takes many different forms, absolutely. Yeah, I just picked kind of quite a common prevailing one, if you like. But some people could be very religious and rebellious. It's unfortunately true. I mean, there are many moments in Israel's history where they remained very religious but were very rebellious. So we can do it in multiple ways. The question is, what is our fundamental attitude to God and to his king? Yeah, thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Of course you can, Rachel.
What you just said, I've got some friends who are really kind of strict Muslim, and how it looks is that they really, really desire God and really want to follow him. And, like, where does that leave them? Are they still rebelling, and is God still kind of laughing at them?
Yeah. Okay, so where does this leave the very sincere, heartfelt person worshipping another God? Yeah, very good question. Let me just say a number of issues get wrapped up in that. So it's worth a sort of worth a seminar sort of thing. But the bottom line answer, I think, is that ultimately, yes, they are still rebelling, because idolatry is another way to rebel. So you never get the very sincere worshipper of Baal.
So they're not really worshipping God at all anyway, not even in their heart and their desire, even though it might look like that, or they might think that.
They're certainly not worshipping the true God. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. And I was going to say that because of, say, things like other religions in the Old Testament, very sincere worship, and yet called idolatry because it's a god people have created for themselves. Now, that's not to say things like, well, yeah, when you expand that and open it out, it's not to say there aren't elements of truth in other religions and so on. Not that everything they say is always wrong, but if you like, the final thing they end up with is a rejection of Jesus. And I think the Bible's very clear that those who reject Jesus are rejecting the Father who sent him. So, other contributions, things that have struck you, or questions? Yeah, go on.
Thinking about the prophecy about Jesus here, what would have the people around the time of the psalm being written understood about that? Would they be fully aware of
that meaning? Very good question. What would the people who read and sung Psalm 2 have thought about who it was about? Well, let me put the caveat in again first. There's a wider discussion there. There's a variety of opinion on how clear people think predictions of Jesus are in the Old Testament, and hence what level of knowledge people have about them in the Old Testament. So my own view, personally, would be that you get it, if you like, increasingly clear understanding of the person and work of Jesus as the Old Testament goes through. And so Psalm 2, I think, is quite a good example where I think they'd have gone, oh, people rebelling against the Lord and his anointed. Well, that's the king. People rebelling against Israel and the king of Israel. And so their very first thought might have been for their king, but as they read on, you know, I'll give the inheritance to him, the nations to him as an inheritance, the ends of the earth. You know, he'll shatter people like pottery. You think, well, that's never fulfilled in any king of Israel. And in fact, other stuff elsewhere in the Bible about the kings of Israel, they're not promised that sort of thing. And so I think that someone reading Psalm 2 of their day, it would have only taken a few moments' reflection for them to think God is promising something for the future that is not fulfilled in a king here and now. But exactly what level of knowledge they have is debated. What sort of music is it? What do you think? Suggestions on music? Seriously, what's the mood of this psalm?
Reggae.
Red. Whatever it is, Stu, it's not reggae. I think it's got both somber elements because of the seriousness of what people are doing, and it has very triumphant, confident elements in it. And with what blend of that it would come up with, I don't know, but we should sing this. I think both soberly, thinking the world is rebelling against its creator, and one day we'll stand before him, and yet also very confidently knowing he's our king and he will rule, and every knee will bow before him. So something of that nature.